future is now. And welcome to the SVK Crypto Podcast. 15 minutes of crypto fame.
My name is Charles Story, and today we have a very special show. We have Sam Englebart on the show today as our special guest speaker. Sam is the co-founder of Galaxy Digital. He's also one of the founding partners of Galaxy Digital itself. Sam co-runs the principal investment business for Galaxy Digital. If you haven't heard of Galaxy Digital already, what have you been doing? But that's okay, I've got your back, as always, so let me bring you up to speed. Galaxy Digital is a diversified merchant bank dedicated to the digital assets and blockchain technology industry. They're one of the leading venture capital firms within the space. It was an absolute honor to hear Sam's story, his views, where he sees the market going, why Galaxy Digital is so interested in blockchain gaming projects, why blockchain is one of the most exciting opportunities he's seen, but most importantly, what makes him tick and how does he view the market? We discuss EOS and the future applications within the EOS.io blockchain. So with that in mind, let's get down to business. Let's get into the interview. So on today's show, we have one of the founding partners of Galaxy Digital, Sam Englebart. So Sam is, well, co-runs the principal investment business for Galaxy Digital. If you haven't heard of Galaxy Digital already, it's a diversified merchant bank dedicated to the digital assets and blockchain technology industry. Sam, how is it going?
Oh, it's going great. Glad to be here, Charles.
Thanks for making it. I know you're super busy with a jam-packed schedule. So Sam, let's start at the beginning. I think that's the best place to start. Where did you grow up?
Well, I was born in Cleveland, Ohio, which some people who know me know that, although I don't usually lead with it. I was born in Shaker Heights in Cleveland and grew up there till I was five and moved. My dad is from upstate New York originally, and he's a surgeon and moved us when I was five to a little town outside of Albany, New York, called Schenectady, New York, which I always tell people, I think, I don't know what that means exactly, but it's some Native American tongue for next to Albany, I think.
And what was it like growing up there?
Schenectady is a small, what can I say? It's a small little town. My parents still live there. And now I moved back to New York a couple of years ago from Los Angeles. But so I get up to Schenectady more now than I have over the last 10 or 15 years. But it's a little town that was a sort of bustling industrial town and the home of GE and a bunch of interesting things 100 years ago. And it, to be completely honest, it feels a little bit like, you know, one of these towns that time forgot. A lot of beautiful things. My dad always said that growing up, because I would ask how come we didn't live in New York, or how come, I remember at one point he told me all the different parts of the world that he was thinking about setting up his medical practice. And on this list would be cities like, you know, Manhattan or Los Angeles, or even little towns that I've subsequently spent some time in, like Portland, Oregon, or Boulder, Colorado, and all these amazing places. And then we wound up in Schenectady. And my dad's answer was always that Schenectady is this incredible town. We're 2 hours away, 2 hours from Manhattan, we're 2 hours from Boston. And I mean, to me, it always felt like kind of exactly, we're 2 hours from everything and there's nothing to do. But, you know, we have the Adirondack Mountains and lakes that don't allow motorized boats in them and all kinds of stuff that I probably appreciate more now than I did when I was a kid.
Well, Sam, am I right in thinking you studied philosophy and then political science at Boulder, Colorado, then going to Harvard Law School, graduating with a doctorate of law?
That is correct. The order is a little different. I actually started in Colorado with a focus on political science and economics. And then I added philosophy at the end of my first year. And then I did end up going to Harvard. Originally thinking when I went there, I actually planned on going into academia. I didn't really go to Harvard thinking I was going to be a lawyer, but I went thinking I wanted to get a JD degree and probably a PhD in philosophy and be a teacher, be a professor and be an academic. And then somewhere along the way, I took a very different turn or two.
And what do you think? What do you think kind of made that turn become a reality? What were the deciding factors in your head?
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting. For me, the people that know me, and this is somewhat relevant, we'll get back to it, I guess, as we talk about why this technology is interesting to me. But I have a very obsessive personality, and always have. And I don't know that I've ever been or directed my interest on, you know, a particular thing as much as just really loving the process of mastering a whole variety of things, or attempting to master them anyway. And so philosophy for me was one of those things where, I mean, prior to college, and even when I went to Colorado, I really went there primarily interested in skiing. I was a very passionate skier and also passionate about a whole lot of things, none of which were academics, really. I was always sort of very interested in learning and reading and thinking, less interested in attending class and, you know, doing things in the sort of formal academic way. And then somewhere in the first year of school, I just got incredibly passionate about philosophy. And I think primarily because I had a great mentor in Boulder, Colorado, who introduced me to a whole lot of things, and he was really instrumental in sort of encouraging me to take all this stuff that I was reading away from school, which was a whole lot of philosophy and history and you know, social sciences related things, and actually figure out how to study them and apply them to what I was thinking about and what I was doing. So I got super interested in philosophy, and that sort of led to the to this decision to go to law school. But what I was primarily focused on in terms of my philosophy studies was personal identity, and personal identity through time, and sort of metaphysics around what how the world may be very different from what we perceive it to be, and how we think of ourselves over the course of our lives. And that kind of got me really exploring this idea of what does personhood mean? And somewhere in there were a lot of thought experiments about what if we actually were living in a simulation, and what is this world if it's not the physical world we see? What is it actually that we're experiencing? And so later when the opportunity to kind of dig deeper into VR and virtual reality and these questions of metaverses and so on, it just triggered all of this interest that I had at one time in these philosophical questions, and kind of is a big part of how I got really excited about the technology things that we're focused on now.
Philosophy plays a big part in that, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, you can kind of follow a line from, you know, there's this idea out there that, you know, all of philosophy is a footnote to Plato. It has been said, and I don't remember exactly who said that, but you know, this idea that in many ways, and it's so fascinating, that you go in and you read these guys, and they asked all the big questions. There's this problem with modern philosophy, and particularly sort of analytical philosophy, which is the much more sort of precise and rigorous sort of math and logic based philosophy that in the 19th and 20th centuries sort of spun off away from what we think of as like continental philosophy, which is more of the existentialists and more of the people that you might read and sit down and find their writing to be much more prose and much more sort of big picture and thinking about sort of the problems of life. And so this sort of analytical philosophy, which ended up being how most of the 20th century tackled questions around philosophy of mind and metaphysics and epistemology and these things, so they were kind of coming back and trying to apply this analytical rigor to some of the questions that were raised in a much more prose way by the ancient philosophers. But if you follow kind of through the line of philosophy and history of philosophy, you get from the ancient philosophers, you get into, one of the first philosophers to really explore these issues of that come back again in this conversation about the metaverse or about this idea of are we living, in a simulation. You get people like Descartes, who famously, kind of explored this thought experiment of are we a brain in a vat?
Right.
And then into the 20th century, the analytical philosophers that like, guys like David Chalmers, who started to ask a lot of these questions and attempt to figure out what is consciousness and, you know, what's happening when we have these perceptions of ourself and others and what does all that mean? And then more behaviorist focused and physical sort of people who think the answers to consciousness lie in the our physical constitution, people like Daniel Dennett and other people like that. They were all important. A philosopher named Colin McGinn was a really important sort of influence on me. And I had, you know, I got really lucky. I had the opportunity because of this mentor that I mentioned in Colorado named George Beeler. He introduced me to someone who became one of my first real academic mentors, a philosopher named Galen Strawson, who was over at Jesus College in Oxford. And so I went, while I was still in undergrad in Colorado, I went and spent a year studying with him in Oxford and really exploring this passion that was developing in me for the subject matter. Example of following what had previously been like my obsessiveness or, you know, kind of had previously manifested itself mostly in trying to master physical things like skiing or golf or even bowling or just any weird thing that I would try to do. I had this tendency to try to really just master it and become excellent at it. And then for the first time when I was in college, that played out in this interest in philosophy. And there's a running theme, I think, as we talk about the stuff that I've done, where I tend to get passionate about something and just follow it to wherever it leads.
So was that the same with law?
Yeah, I mean, law again for me was not so much about wanting to be a lawyer. It was the law school was a little bit of a hedge for me, where I was thinking I wanted to be an academic philosopher, and my parents and other people sort of said, "Hey, you know, maybe you should do that by way of getting a law degree, because just in case this academic thing doesn't really play out." You know, there's a lot you can do with a JD from Harvard, really. And so that was kind of how it went.
So Sam, where does your career begin? Like, where does this start? Where does the journey begin?
I mean, if by career we mean how am I going to find a way to make money, you know, and support myself, you know, through my daily activities, which is one way I generally define career, although I am one of these people, I feel incredibly lucky that I've managed to be able to support myself without feeling at any point along the way like I had a job. So for me, it's always been, how can I find something that I wake up in the morning really wanting to do that people will pay me to do? So I guess I would say that part of my life began when I was still in law school. One of the other things that I was also very passionate about was film. And I had moved out to LA in the summer between my second and third year of law school, mainly because my sister moved from New York to LA and I went and visited her. I'd never really been to LA before. And I just loved everything about it then. I loved the weather. I loved the sort of freedom that I still think is unique to Los Angeles in the United States, and a sort of entrepreneurial spirit about people where you could really go and invent or reinvent yourself and be whoever you want to be. And for me, I was working at a law firm. By this point, by the end of my second year of law school, I had decided I was not going to stay in school and get a PhD in philosophy. The thought of being in school for 8 more years, there was just no way I was going to do it. And law school, so I figured, all right, you know what? I might as well actually try the law thing and see if it's something that I want to do. I won't even get into the details of the fact that I also took a year off between my first year and second year of law school, because I was trying to figure out where my passions sort of lay and what I wanted to focus on. And so I moved to New York. Harvard had this great program where you could take a year off with no questions asked. In fact, you could take up to 2 years off with no questions asked and come back when you're ready. So I'd had a sort of a business opportunity in New York through a family friend So I went and I said, I'll try living in Manhattan and see you how I feel about this. And so I moved to New York on September 8th, 2001. And 3 days later, 9/11 happened, and that job, went away. And I didn't want to stay in New York after, after 9/11. It's kind of a really tough place to be then. And I had to wait until September to go back to school. So I moved to Spain, and I lived on a very, very tight budget in Spain, and taught myself to speak Spanish fluently, and continued doing a lot of reading and a lot of thinking, and just meeting everybody that I could meet. And it was one of these accidental years off, really, that turned out to be one of the most important in my life. And so when I went back to Harvard, now for what would be the start of my second year, law school is a 3-year program. So I went back there and decided, okay, I'm going to actually see what being a lawyer is like. So my sister had moved out to LA. I went and visited her in the, in the winter of that year, when you're trying to figure out where you're going to work, for your summer, they call it a summer associate program. I went out there, fell in love with LA, originally planned on spending half my summer at a firm in Los Angeles and half, at the same firm's offices in New York. And by the time summer came around and I was living in Los Angeles, I canceled the New York part and just decided to stay in LA and work in LA that entire. So I was also really passionate about film and content, and decided I would explore what entertainment law looked like. So I spent that summer doing every possible assignment I could in and around entertainment law, and particularly film and television financing. There wasn't a lot to do inside of a corporate legal firm, although the firm I was at, called O'Melveny & Myers, had a really robust entertainment law practice, mostly representing studios and other sort of large, entertainment industry businesses. And so that was kind of how I started looking at the entertainment industry. I think it was kind of in my nature to be somewhat entrepreneurial. And so by the time the summer was over, I had already pretty much decided that I was probably not going to practice law at a firm for a very long time, but this film business is pretty interesting. And maybe I could be some, maybe I could apply some of the legal work and segue into something more entrepreneurial in the film business. And so I went back to Harvard for the start of my third year, and already kind of deciding, all right, I think I want to start a business of some kind and be involved in film. What am I going to do? I started a company in the fall of my third year of law school, focusing on financing film and television shows. And I had a good friend who was living in LA, who is an incredible entrepreneur, and had built a bunch of businesses, none of which had anything to do with film, but he had decided that he also was passionate about film, and as a sort of a side hobby, he was gonna approach financing, certain film projects that were interesting to him. So he and I spent a lot of time, even that summer when I was out in LA working for the law firm, we spent a lot of time talking about it. And he actually we came up with a business plan. He had this idea at the time that there was a real opportunity to come in with an opportunistic piece of the financing for film projects, and really be kind of the last money in and the first money out to help certain film projects complete their financing and get made. And if you were positioned in the right way, you could really step in and get a phenomenal and relatively low risk return on your money and be an integral part of getting the film project financed and off the ground. So we wrote a business plan for that. It was the first business plan I ever wrote. And he seeded the business with $500,000. And we set out to get a bunch of movies financed. And we ended up getting a bunch of projects off the ground. And the movies that we were financing, one went to the Cannes Film Festival and premiered there, and one premiered at Sundance. And, suddenly we were really getting deeply involved with the independent film world, which in 2002, 2003 was a pretty interesting place to be. And we were focusing on working with these kind of renegade artists that were making projects that were otherwise, they were telling a really important, interesting story, but otherwise were pretty hard to get made because they were not your typical sort of studio fare and commercial project. So, you know, I think we stumbled into it, but we turned out to be a sort of pioneers in a form of financing for films that then became a really important way for these independent films to get made. So that company was called Arrival Cinema. And, you know, we had one other business partner who was a good friend of mine from Boston that I had met while I was at Harvard, who was really like the only person running around Cambridge, Massachusetts, you know, trying to raise money for movie projects. And so her name's Era, and Era and Chad and I, next thing you know, we were operating this business. It became pretty clear during that year that I wanted to keep trying to build that business. And so when I graduated in 2000 and in May of 2004, I had already spent most of the prior year in Los Angeles. I moved out full time to LA. I did take the bar exam, took and passed the bar exam. I'm technically a licensed attorney in the state of California, although on inactive status now, but I never, other than, you know, doing the legal work for the projects that we were financing, I never really practiced law in the service of outside clients anyway. And so we built that business, and we realized pretty quickly that it was a great idea, and it was a really good way to become sort of an important part of the film and television industry at a young age and with no real prior experience in film and TV. But it was also pretty clear that there was a ceiling on how big that business was going to be able to be. Few years of living in Los Angeles and in sort of operating this financing company and production company, I met a guy named Michael Lambert, who became my first really important and close long-term business mentor and eventually partner. So in 2006, I met Michael, and then he's a guy who has had a long and amazing career in traditional media. He was the president of Fox Television, you know, in the 80s under Barry Diller, and then you know, after Diller was sort of ousted from Fox in the early 90s, Diller's close team was replaced as well. And so Michael found himself in a place of needing to find what he was going to do with the rest of his life. He was kind of the age that I am now. I guess he was about 40 years old, and, you know, had this really amazing career in the television industry. And he ended up, long story short, ended up buying a television station, cobbling together the money to buy a television station. And that turned into, you know, one of the most successful purchase and sales of an independent TV station ever. You know, I think he bought it for $2 million and sold it a few years later for $100 million. And suddenly he was this brilliant media private equity guy. Wow. And then he took that and into a career building, in the 90s, building movie theaters and buying and flipping a bunch more TV stations and other things. When I met him, we met socially, became really good friends and just connected on a whole lot of different things. And he eventually talked me into coming over and working with him. And we didn't really know what we were going to do. But again, like for me, the pattern continues of just really allowing passion and intellectual curiosity to drive how I decide to spend my time. And so I went with Michael. And
well, what age were you at this time, Sam? How old were you?
I was 20. I was at this point, I was 28, something like that. 2000. So 79, so yeah, I was 27, 28.
And if you were to go back to your 28-year-old self and the position that you were just about to start a new thing with someone who's had a successful exit, what would you tell yourself knowing what you know now from just life, from just experience in the industry? what lessons would you tell yourself?
Well, you know what's dangerous about that is I might have told myself not to do it at all the way that I did it then. I might have told myself to be more conservative. I might have told myself to follow more of a straight line. And I think that would have been an enormous mistake, actually, because ultimately what you should always be telling yourself. And again, if you're lucky enough to do it, and I didn't have the benefit of a, you know, I didn't have a trust fund or any ability to just wing it. I had to find a way to support myself. But I just wasn't willing to, do it by any other, person's rules or playbook. So
Sam's way or the highway.
What's going to get you excited when you wake up in the morning and, and who is out there that you want to spend your time with?
Right.
So I kind of had and to be completely honest with you, I don't know whether this was fully formed in my consciousness or whether I'm looking back at it now and realizing it was the way that I was living my life. But I had this idea that if I put myself in a place where I want to live, doing and thinking about things that I find interesting with people who I respect, good things are going to happen.
I love
that. And that is probably the best way that I can summarize the my playbook. And it's just, everybody's got to do it their own way. Jumping into this role with Michael, and I had no idea what we were going to do. He had just bought with some partners, who also became incredibly important mentors to me over the years. He had just bought half of a film production company called Village Roadshow Pictures, which, is a film financing partnership with Warner Brothers. And I went in there, the ink was just drying on that deal. And I went in there and my job was to help Michael figure out as a board member, Michael was a board member of the company then, how best to create value in that business. And then that became the two of us, with some of these same partners, attempting to build, in a deal that was not particularly successful, but attempting to build this really interesting brand of high-end movie theaters that was called Gold Class Cinemas. And the idea there was like, let's build these incredible theaters where, none of the auditoriums have more than 40 seats and you sit in it and, we serve you a 3-star meal or 5-star meal, however you want to think about that, and great drinks and everything. And you sit in these comfortable first class kind of seats that recline all the way and you watch a movie. And we never got the business model right there. We built 7 of these things from the ground up and then exited to a company called iPic, which is still building these types of theaters. But learning the movie theater business on that, on that trajectory ended up, we somewhere in there as we were building Gold Class, we had an opportunity to buy another chain of movie theaters. Most of the theaters under this brand, National Amusements, which was Sumner Redstone's family movie exhibition business. And so sort of Gold Class turned us on to National Amusements, and we bought all of the National Amusements theaters except for the ones that were located in Metro New York and Boston. Sumner's and his family kept those. And we bought another chain called Rave. At the time, it was called Rave Motion Pictures.
Rave Motion Pictures.
Rave, R-A-V. And we put those together. And that was sort of my life from 2009 to 2013 was largely, helping to build that business. It was a large private equity transaction. And we built that. And we ended up with the fourth largest chain of movie theaters in the country. And we sold that business to the third largest chain, to a company called Cinemark. And again, that was like, now I had because Michael had put his arm around me and said, come in here and take a chance and do this. Now I was with him in really making myself an expert in traditional media investing. And we did a lot of stuff in and around that, with record labels and with a bunch of other businesses. And this is all relevant because if you were investing in traditional media from 2004, 2005 to 2010, 2011, 12, there was no way that you weren't going to cross over into digital media, because all of these industries were being rapidly transformed by digital technology. So I was not a technologist at all prior to getting into media investing and into film and TV and movie theaters. But the more that I learned about digital media, and now we're talking about the early years of YouTube and streaming content and MCNs and just like all this interesting stuff was going on. And I think again, I was just fascinated by it. So I just dove into it we started to invest in some early stage venture deals, mainly because we just said, well, I don't know, how do you invest in digital media? There's no late stage companies to go buy, but let's make some seed stage bets. And that was the start of my sort of venture capital.
Sam, tell me, career. So your philosophy of being in the right place, enjoying what you do, how did Galaxy Digital come into the equation? Tell me the story of how that started.
So what happened there was, so by this point, by 2016, I had now been investing for several years in early stage technology companies. This started because it was an evolution of investing in old media. We started investing in new media. I invested in a couple of video game companies. I invested in a company called iFluence, which was, when it was first pitched to me, it was meant to be an eye tracking technology that was going to, be relevant as heads-up displays were going to be. The thinking in 2011, 2012 was, it was AR and it was heads-up displays, or it was iPhones was actually a project that was developed internally at Google to be eye tracking that was going to be used on the Google Glass, which was a project they were working on then. It was going to be Google's first AR headset. And all of this stuff tied into media because everybody's thinking about how are we going to consume content. And so I invested in iFluence, but by the time we actually closed the deal, virtual reality had taken off. And now it's 2013, or 2012, 2013, and Oculus was suddenly a thing, and Facebook was buying them. And iFluence spun out of Google with an incredible CEO named Jim Margraff. And it was gonna be eye tracking technology for inside of VR headsets. And that was when all of a sudden I was really going deep down the rabbit hole of VR. And that triggered in me all of these thoughts about the sort of all these big thought experiments and things that I was interested in from philosophy. And I just got super passionate about VR. And I ended up getting really involved with a few different companies as an investor and as an advisor, a company called The Void, which builds these amazing location-based retail centers effectively, where you go in and you get to have a 5 to 10 minute immersive VR experience with your friends and enter whatever world it is that they're creating for you. And that was like the first incredible eye-opening technology moment for me. And then I just, from there, it was like obvious to me, I was just going to focus on as deep sort of interesting future tech as I could. And so I spent, at the time I was running one of our other portfolio companies, which was a film production and TV production company. Again, I'd sort of, I was spending a lot of time with that company. And I just woke up one day and realized, like, I really was not passionate about film and TV. And I was going to focus on future tech. And one of the technologies that I was exposed to early, just because of some good friends that I have that were real pioneers in space, guys like Brock Pierce, who we can get into the whole, how that whole story comes back around. But I was living in Venice, California, which in 2013, 14, 15, and even later was one of the major hubs of crypto and blockchain. And I knew a lot of the people because of the tech investing I was doing. I knew a lot of people that were really driving the space. And Brock had convinced me to buy Bitcoin in 2013. He tried to get me to buy it in 2011. But I finally bought my first Bitcoin in 2013. And for several years, it was actually something that I was passively, had invested a little bit in, but wasn't paying a whole lot of attention. And I was really focused on VR and really focused on that sort of area. But I was paying attention, and people that I respect and I thought were really smart were telling me to focus more on blockchain and crypto because it was going to be really important. And like everything else for me, the more that I studied and the more that I read, the more convinced I became that it was that they were right. And so with other friends, we had this little group by 2016. Guys, William Quigley, who has gone on to create Wax, and Lonnie Steindorf, who runs a firm called Distributed Global, and Brock, and a guy named Scott Walker, who had a firm called DNA and has been a real, you know, pioneer in the space. All these guys, we had like a regular, they were all in LA, and we had a regular dinner group that met once a week. And so we would get together and talk about it. And, you know, Ethereum had happened. So they had bought Ethereum. They bought ETH sooner than I did, but not too long after that. You know, I bought some, and it was kind of just, you know, it was the Wild West, and you get into this stuff and you learn about it, and it looked like it was going to be incredibly important. But, you know, I'd been around for long enough that I didn't really know how that was going to happen or what was going to happen. And I wasn't going to stop doing the VR stuff I was doing or the other tech stuff that I was doing. But I was, you know, I was paying a lot more attention. And we had invested in my partners and I had invested in, you know, early in what's now called Blockchain Capital. So that was, you know, Brad and Bart Stevens and Brock. And that was one of the first really dedicated crypto and blockchain VC funds. So that was it. I was like in this learning process again, and doing the, you know, doing it the way that I do, which is to just to start really trying to get as smart as I could about what was going on. And along the way, my girlfriend Megan, who I live with here in New York, took me on a trip to Haiti with a charity that she was involved in. And we met Mike Novogratz on that trip. And that was, you know, Mike and his wife Suki were there with this organization. It's called Artists for Peace and Justice. And we had this weekend in Haiti. And by the end of the weekend, Mike and I really hit it off. And I realized that, oh, this is pretty interesting. Like, Mike is doing a lot of different stuff. At the time, he had left Fortress. He was thinking about his next moves and what he was going to do, and decided to institutionalize his family office, you know, as opposed to going and raising another big, you know, hedge fund or managing other people's money. At the time, he had decided what he wanted to do was really was just build out a little bit of a team and manage his own money that way. So nothing happened immediately, but I was coming back and forth between LA and New York because Megan lived in New York and I lived in LA. So I was spending, you know, a lot of time in New York. And when I would come to town, I'd get together with Mike and we would, you know, we realized we both had, you know, some investments in different crypto and blockchain projects. You know, Mike, most people know Mike's story. I don't need to tell that again, but he was early to Bitcoin and early to Ethereum and, you know, college roommates with Joe Lubin. And so he had Bitcoin and he had ETH and he had a guy working for him that was trading, you know, some of the other stuff that he was doing. He invested in some mining and things. And he and I really, I think we just hit it off socially and then we hit it off and bonded around not just crypto, but VR and other venture projects. And so he came to LA a couple times and I took him around to, you know, to see The Void because I, you know, I was a shareholder in that company. I took him to see some other projects that were doing interesting things in VR. I took him to meet Brock, who he hadn't met yet, but, you know, and to hear more about what Brock was doing with, you know, at the time there wasn't even Block One or EOS, but, you know, they were starting to put that deal together. And we just were like sharing notes, not with a plan for me to go, you know, to move to New York and work for Mike, but eventually that's what we landed on. And it was another one of these situations where I had a feeling about Mike. I really, you know, most importantly, I trusted him. I thought then, and I still think that he's just a fascinating and really good person who shares a lot of the same, views about the world that I do and wants to roll up his sleeves and, you know, explore what's possible. So it didn't take a lot of thought, really. I mean, again, by this point, I was fortunately in a position where, you know, because of the other things that I'd done, you know, I could pick up and move, and I could, you know, take an entrepreneurial chance on myself without knowing exactly what it was going to be. And I had a good reason because Megan was in New York and we were trying to find a way to, you know, spend more time together. I mean, I think it was at one breakfast that Mike and I had, he kind of put his arm around me and said, you know, Sam, he loves Megan. He just said, you know, Megan's going to dump you if you don't move to New York. So you better figure something out. Shit, you know what? You're probably right. And I don't know how much time I've got. And you know, shortly after that he said,
come on over. I don't really have anybody doing venture for the family office. So I came to New York to be in charge of the venture investments for Mike's family office. And he had a couple other people that he'd brought on board who then became my partners in Galaxy Digital.
And once again, it goes back to being at the right time. We're being at the right place at the right time with doing what you want to do, right? With the right people. And I think that just seeds perfectly into that story. So let's kind of go forward a little bit in time here, Sam. So can you tell us the story behind Galaxy Digital creating an EOS ecosystem fund? Because it kind of blends in with what was going on over in LA.
Yeah, sure. So it'll help. I'll take 30 seconds to just make sure we're clear on the difference between Galaxy Digital and Mike's family office and what that is. Because so I joined Mike, and at the time his family office was called Novo Fam. We quickly changed the name to Galaxy Investment Partners. And Mike's family office today is still called Galaxy Investment Partners. We were not planning, when I moved to New York, there was no plan to build an operating company and go and you know, build a merchant bank and, you know, what is now a publicly traded merchant bank called Galaxy Digital and so on. It was really, we were going to be a family office. We were going to invest, you know, Mike's money and manage his money as a family office. And when I joined, you know, 15% of his assets were probably in, you know, were it was something like that in terms of the amount of money that was in crypto. And then as this massive bull market happened, suddenly that became a much bigger percentage of his net worth. And we had also started to add resources to the team to manage the crypto and blockchain piece of the business. And in the process of doing that, plus the fact that, you know, a lot of other people were out there, far less qualified than Mike and us to build an institutional investment firm. They were out there running around doing it, and Mike and my partner Chris Ferraro and my partner Kim Pillemer and a few others, we sort of said, all right, is there an opportunity for us here to build a business as well and build an operating company as well, and should we do that? And we decided, yes, we should. So we created Galaxy Digital, and we said, well, what are we going to be? We explored briefly the idea of, are we just going to launch a hedge fund? Because a lot of people were doing that, and obviously Mike has an incredible track record, having been a macro hedge fund manager, his entire career at Goldman, and being there when they went public, and then he started Fortress and took that company public, and he's just been one of the real pioneers and leading macro hedge fund managers. So the first thought was, let's start a hedge fund, and we explored it briefly, and then quickly decided, you know, the timing was not right. The market was exploding. And Mike sort of said, I don't want to be the guy that starts the macro hedge fund at the top tick. So what are the other opportunities and what are we going to do? So we sort of tabled the hedge fund idea and then actually realized that opportunistically that we could be more of a diversified operating company and be, you know, we say we're a merchant bank, which really just means we're an investment bank with a balance sheet to make our own investments. And we said, let's do that because I think we can be, an investment firm, and we're doing that well already, and we can continue to invest capital in crypto and blockchain technology and projects, you know, in and around that ecosystem. But let's build out, since we can, let's build out an advisory piece to the business as well. You know, both an advisory business that helps people raise capital for the projects that that need financing, and also we believed then, and we certainly believe now more than ever, that there's going to be a lot of M&A activity in the space. And so let's be an advisory firm that can really be leaders, experts in the underlying technology, and help companies big and small consolidate. Because as with any of these new technologies, eventually there's going to be a round of consolidation, and we want it to be right there. And then given Mike's background as a trader, obviously anything we did was going to have a strong trading component. And so the three real legs of our business became investment, advisory, and trading. And that company is Galaxy Digital. And we it was an amazing moment where we were able to
We had a lot of assets in crypto and blockchain on the family office balance sheet. We were able to sort of contribute them to the balance sheet of this new company that we started. And we successfully raised another $250 million. And we took this whole operation public on the TSXV in Canada.
So tell me about the EOS Fund itself.
Yeah, so leading it in, so the EOS Fund, what we were investors. I was individually an investor in the first round of financing for Block One, which I'm sure everybody listening to this knows Block One is the software development company that created the EOS.io protocol, and they conducted a token sale for a year and launched the protocol, which is now obviously it's a decentralized protocol, and it's no longer run by Block One. But the history there was in the course of conducting the token sale, Block One created a sizable balance sheet for itself, and they committed $1 billion of the proceeds from the token from the EOS token sale to venture capital that supports the EOS ecosystem. So that $1 billion was divided up. 600 million of it was divided up across five funds, just sort of geographically diverse funds. And 400 million of it was kept for direct investments from Block One's internal VC arm called EOS VC. So the 600 million that was farmed out to managers. We are one of those five funds. I think that really we had a good, strong relationship with the Block One team going back to the formation of the company, through Brock and through Brock, Mike and I met Brendan Bloomer, and Dan, and we were just big believers in them and the team and what they were building from the very beginning. And then when they set out to create these ecosystem funds, I think we were an obvious and strong choice, just given that we have a really experienced team of professional investors and people who've been doing this for a long time in a lot of different ways. We have the resources and the infrastructure to be a really robust operation across the entire blockchain and crypto space, and I think to be very strong advocates for EOS itself. So they, we feel really fortunate. We've got a great partnership with them. We are, in business with them in a number of different ways, and they gave us entrusted us with $300 million of their money to manage and to build out the ecosystem. So that's how it started, and it really just. Good, strong personal relationships, mutually beneficial business relationships. And, they're Block One is an investor in our company and we're an investor in their company. And now we co-manage this Galaxy EOS ecosystem fund.
Sam, this brings me on to one of my favorite questions of the show. In your own words, what do you see as the real value in blockchain technology?
So, I think the real value in blockchain is still to be determined. We're going to see, the various ways that it plays out over, over the coming years. One of the things we have to do is say, well, what do we even mean by blockchain, right? And there's a lot of different blockchains out there, and different blockchains are architected to do different things. And I think depending on which architecture we're talking about and how a particular blockchain is governed and how decentralized it is and all the things that we examine and ask ourselves when you look at different protocols, they're going to bring different value to the table. I think ultimately, I really believe that we'll look back and say some form of a blockchain of a decentralized database will be important to every company in the way that a website is important to every company, and for some it will be more important than to others, and for some Maximum decentralization will be critical. I think if you're a, you know, censorship resistant, store value, decentralized money project, the how decentralized it is going to be critical, and it's going to have to be maximally decentralized. I think if you're talking about creating enough decentralization to remove some of the inefficiencies and concerns that we have and we're starting to recognize in very top-down centralized businesses, then, you know, maybe a less decentralized architecture will be okay, but sufficiently decentralized to solve the problems that the business faces or to enable certain things that were previously impossible with a totally centralized server.
Of course. Now, I want to keep on the blockchain subject, but I want to talk about gaming. I know Galaxy Digital have been deploying capital into the blockchain gaming space. I mean, what excites you most about gaming, given your impressive background with media, VR? What do you see the future of gaming looking like with blockchain technology?
Yeah, so I mean, I really believe that the first way, or certainly one of the first ways that blockchain is going to touch the consumer with any scale is through games. I'm fascinated by games, and it's an extension of my interest, I think, in media and in broadly entertainment. But I think gaming is particularly fascinating because it really is it's at this intersection of technology and content. And ultimately, if we believe, as I do, that we're going to just spend an increasing amount of time and an increasing amount of our lives inside of digital worlds, gaming, it's the entry point for a lot of people. It's not, to me, intellectually, I'm more interested in what happens beyond just gaming and what do these worlds we create for ourselves look like when we start spending more of the time just interacting with each other and living with each other and socializing with each other in digital worlds than, you know, running around in a battle royale situation trying to shoot each other. But I think that the first entry point for most people into this, you know, much more consuming digital life experience is going to be in some form of a game. So I'm just intellectually fascinated with how we're going to engage and what the world is going to look like. And
yeah, I mean, if you look at Wax, which is a company you know very well, knowing the CEO personally, you know, in-game items as well is another huge, huge asset sector. And looking further down the road, you know, I see a marketplace for all of these different in-game items to be traded upon. I know different people are building this. And that's something that's going to be helped massively by non-fungible tokens. So on that non-fungible token NFT topic, what do you see, or how do you see NFTs playing their role in tomorrow's future? What do you see the power of these tokens?
Yeah, so I mean... So if we believe we're going to be spending a tremendous amount of our time in digital worlds, you know, NFTs, it's really just another way of saying it's the digital stuff that people are going to own and trade. So as we spend more time in digital worlds and games and then beyond games and into sort of this idea of the metaverse that we've talked about, we define ourselves in the world by the things that we own. It's not entirely, but it's a big part of our identity and of who we are. And for that to matter, we need to know that we can create and own and share and trade things that are scarce. And so really all an NFT means is it is a digitally scarce item. And if you believe you're spending most of your time in a digital world, then inside of these digital worlds, everything is potentially an NFT. And so, you know, that and blockchain is what makes it possible to create digital scarcity. So, I mean, is that clear to you? Because that's really, to me, what it's about. It's about how are we going to own and interact with and trade the stuff that defines us?
Yeah, I mean, that itself I see being built out right now is one of the most exciting elements and one of the most exciting points at the minute. We're seeing more and more dApps interacting with NFT tokens. We're seeing more build out in that area as well, which is something that excites us. Sam, you spoke a lot about metaverse. What is the metaverse and why does it need to be built on blockchain?
The idea that the metaverse needs to be built on the blockchain, first of all, is it's a thesis. I can't say that I've proven that to be true yet.
I'm sure you've done some thinking on it. You know what I mean? If you look back at the 22-year-old,
yeah, I mean, I've been thinking about it for a long time, and I become increasingly convinced that that it does need to be built on a blockchain. And the reason being that so first of all, what is the metaverse? I mean, metaverse is really just a way to say this digital world that we're going to spend a lot of time in and live in and interact with other people in and so on. So again, like the idea has been expressed over centuries and more recently over the last several decades, it's been in the public consciousness with, movies like The Matrix or recently Ready Player One. In Ready Player One, it was called The Oasis. You know, in The Matrix, it was called The Matrix, but it's this idea that there could be a digital world where you go and you assume a digital identity that may be that may map one to one with the physical identity that you have, in the physical world, or it may be an identity that you're able to create in new and unique ways because it's a digital world. So this is where you can imagine people, reskinning themselves to look different. To change their sex or gender, to have a different accent, to be a completely different person, or to be themselves in a completely different person's body, to do things in this digital world that they consider intrinsic to their identity, but it is somehow different and separate from the physical life that they inhabit when they unplug from this digital world and go about eating and drinking and going to school and doing all those things. So the people who really are fascinated by this idea of a metaverse believe, or many of them anyway, believe that we are going to start spending an increasing amount of time in that metaverse. And we're going to put more and more importance on the digital identity that we create for ourselves in the space. And if you take it really far, some people believe, as I do, that there's a non-trivial chance that we're already in one right now. And so that is this fascinating intellectual thing that's now playing out. Now, what is it in modern, today and in popular culture? We see these big gaming worlds seem to be the first place that we're going to really experience the metaverse. The first monetized version of a metaverse that captured really any attention was this world called Second Life, which an incredible entrepreneur named Philip Rosedale created, and it still exists today, and it still has a robust, vibrant economy. People are buying and selling and trading virtual objects and living inside of the world of Second Life. It never scaled to mass adoption. But the GDP of Second Life today is somewhere in the sort of $750 million size. You have 50,000 very active, passionate people spending their time inside of Second Life every day, and many people who have built for themselves 7- and 8-figure businesses creating, buying, selling digital objects. So move forward a little bit, and from Second Life, we've started to see the emergence of these very big gaming platforms, where suddenly you have one of the biggest ones that people have heard of, although there are several, but Fortnite, for example, which was created by a company called Epic, which was originally known and best known even 2-3 years ago for being for creating one of the major game rendering engines called the Unreal Engine. So from that, they sort of created their own world and their own game called Fortnite. And when they took that game and sort of structured it as a battle royale, 100 people drop into a world and they fight each other, and the last person standing wins. And that just set off this frenzy, to several hundred million people now play Fortnite, and and spend an incredible amount of time each day in Fortnite. Now, why this is relevant for the metaverse is what's happened is we're already starting to see these signs that whereas 6 months ago, you know, every minute that people are in the Fortnite world, they were in the world playing the Battle Royale game with an effort to win and be the last person standing. Now, people are starting to spend time doing other things. And we saw a month ago, you know, we had this concert in Fortnite where for 5 minutes, 5 or 10 minutes, people stopped playing the shooting game and actually all gathered in this digital space and listened to a concert from a DJ that was streaming live at a particular time on a Saturday afternoon. And now they're sort of, we're starting to see what a metaverse might look like because, you know, if today 50 minutes of the hour people are running around shooting each other and 10 minutes they're gathering to go do different things and talk to each other and hang out, how much longer until, you know, half of their time is spent playing the game and half of their time is spent hanging out with each other? And how much longer from that before most of the time is spent hanging out and doing different things that are not, quote, gaming, and far less time is actually spent in the shoot 'em up. So I think that's kind of the idea of a metaverse, and we're seeing it play out first in these big scale gaming platforms, and we've got to now understand how are people going to behave going forward. And this brings us back to this idea of the blockchain, because really the idea of the blockchain being important to the metaverse comes from the idea that this metaverse that we create, or however many there are, and there may be a period of time where there are several of them. I don't know that we're going to go instantly to like one metaverse rules. There's going to be these big scale digital worlds. And the really critical question is, does this world need to be open, or can it be a closed architecture like what we see right now in Fortnite? And by that, I mean, at the moment, Fortnite creates digital objects. They monetize themselves entirely by selling you the objects in the game that are not even relevant to winning the game. They really just are a way that people are personalizing their experience and their avatars and their you know, themselves inside of this digital world. And so all of the revenue from Fortnite right now comes from it's you know, what we call a free to play game, but it comes from people buying skins and digital, you know, objects that they use to create their unique identity. Some of us believe, myself included, that ultimately that whole ecosystem needs to be open, and people will need and require, the more that their identity is tied to the digital objects that they buy, they're going to require the ability to own those objects separately and outside of the game itself. Because the more that the more time they invest into creating that identity, the more money that they invest into buying the things that define themselves, the more that they're going to demand that no central publisher in this case can just turn that off, which would effectively mean turning off their identity, shutting them down. And so this question becomes very, very important because people are going to spend a lot more time building these identities for themselves, and eventually they're going to feel there is no separation between the digital identity they've created for themselves and their lives outside of this game world, and they're going to need to be able to behave the way that they've become accustomed to behaving with the stuff that they own and being confident that their identity is not in jeopardy. And if you believe any of what I just told you, some form or version of blockchain technology feels to me like the most likely way that we're going to be able to create, you know, this digital scarcity and provide people with unique ownership of the digital things that they're using to define themselves.
So Sam, with that in mind, what blockchain do you see best fit for this, for the build out of?
Well, I'm biased, obviously, towards EOS, and I'm biased towards EOS, and I also, you know, I do really believe that it's at the moment anyway the best blockchain for the job, and there's no reason why it can't be the blockchain that really is widely recognized as the best one. There are a lot of reasons that we could get into about the differences between the different protocols that are out there. And I will say that, you know, I think this this role is somewhat up for grabs right now. And so a big part of what I'm trying to do in the EOS community and outside of the EOS community is make sure that we all recognize that that there is an opportunity for EOS to really be the blockchain of choice for the people that are going to build out the worlds that may ultimately become this metaverse I'm talking about. And I think there's a big part of what we need to do right now is to educate people first and foremost, and make sure that the EOS community thinks, you know, about the big picture and actually really is motivated to build the tools that it's going to need to build for EOS to be the blockchain that everybody really wants to build on, build these worlds on. You know, there's a lot of advantages to EOS. The fact that it doesn't have transaction fees, the fact that it is by far the fastest right now. And again, I think these worlds are going to require you to be able to exchange objects quickly and at incredibly high scale. So obviously, if we believe that people the world over are going to be spending, you know, enormous amounts of time in these worlds and really living their lives in them, then we're going to need a blockchain that can operate at scaled speeds, capable of handling all the transactions that would take place. And if you imagine, again, everything that everybody's doing in these worlds, mimicking what they do in the real world. So, we can't have a blockchain that can get incredibly congested and slow and expensive every time you want to, transact.
I think one of the examples, Sam, of what you were just saying as well, would be high fidelity, right? Yeah, they're creating exactly a metaverse.
So high fidelity is, in full disclosure, we're large investors in high fidelity and I'm on the board of the company. High fidelity is that same creator I mentioned earlier, Philip Rosedale, who is sort of taking another swing at the metaverse, having built Second Life first, and he's now creating that sort of open architectured metaverse in VR on a blockchain, and he's building it on EOS.
I mean, it's absolutely amazing. And the metaverse that they're creating is, you know, they've obviously looked at Fortnite as well, because I know they had a concert taking place in the high fidelity metaverse itself, which was extremely successful. And they've actually had the world's largest meetup on there as well. I mean, that's insane. And the applications within that as well were education, right? Because people's attention is within the metaverse and now they want to learn and they can be placed inside an Egyptian tomb, for example, and learn about it that way rather than reading a textbook. So the applications within this metaverse are second to none. Like everything's in there.
Yeah. I mean, again, the implications here are enormous. And if you, there are so many, there are so many interesting ways to explore this topic and think about it. And it really is, you can come from the place of just the scarce resources in our physical world. And if you imagine we're in a place of increasing population and increasing challenges with respect to moving around the world and the resources required to do that, the idea that people can and will experience travel in a metaverse or in VR that they would otherwise never be able to do. I mean, many people, millions and millions of people will see the Eiffel Tower for the first time inside of high fidelity or a world like high fidelity. And many people who would otherwise never see it in person will experience it in that world. People are gonna meet their best friends in VR. People are gonna, and inside of a metaverse, people are going to be educated in a way that would never before be possible. The possibilities are just infinitely
massive. I mean, what do you see as kind of a time map for that to really take effect, right? When do you see this really picking up scale and adoption?
I wish I could say it was coming sooner than it is, but this has been, an idea, and we've been talking about it for a long time and developing, sort of putting the building blocks in place for quite a while. I think we still have a little ways to go on the hardware. The progress is being made, but it's 5 years ago, I probably would have said, it would be by 2020 or 2021. It might be a few years later than that, but it's not going to be a lot longer than that. I mean, I think we can hope to have a billion people, in high fidelity, by 2030, 30, if not sooner.
Wow. Sam, with everything we've spoken about today, what excites you most about a decentralized future?
I mean, I think I just said it, really. It's the idea that that we're going to be able to explore worlds never before possible and really do it in a way where we can be confident that the time and money and energy that we're putting into defining ourselves. And if anything, so much of this is just about, you know, who are you and what are you creating for yourself while you're here and what story are you going to be able to tell about your life? The idea that we're going to be able to do that in a way and that these digital worlds will make that possible in a way that's secure and that we can trust we'll be able to take with us, you know, wherever we do end up is really exciting to me.
Sam, I want to thank you so much for taking the time out of your busy schedule today to jump on the show and speak to myself and all the listeners out there as well on your journey, the special journey that you've had and where you see the future going. I've really enjoyed it and I want to thank you for making the time.
My pleasure. Thanks so much, Charles.
I want to say a big thank you once again to Sam for making it on the show. If you haven't already, subscribe to the SVK Crypto Podcast to make sure you don't miss out on any more great interviews coming out. I will also be in Hong Kong next week for Token 2049. So if you're in town, let me know. It'd be great to connect with you. Myself and Shane, co-founder of SVK Crypto, will be out there. Thank you all so much for your time and attention as always. If you haven't already, hit us up on Twitter at @SVK_crypto. Join our community on Telegram. The best way to find our page is SVK Crowd. You find myself and the rest of the team on there. And if you have a project that you'd like us to review, feel free to send it to myself. CStory, CSTORRY. @SVKcrypto.com. That's a wrap, and I've got to bounce.